My name is Anna. If we've never met before, it's so good to see you. And we're just going to be doing a cheeky little mini-series over the next 2 weeks. First of all, me and then Pete James. And we're going to be talking about reckless community. The reason we're talking about reckless community, for those of you who are new, is that our vision as a church is to be a church in the heart of London that seeks to recklessly give itself away to God, each other, to keep people of King's Cross and beyond. And basically, we want to do that in a way that is just, it's embedded in our community. It's who we are. It's part of our DNA. We want to do it in every aspect of our church life. And we want to be defined as a community who recklessly gives themselves away. And so often when we come and do our notices, one of the frustrating things is that sometimes it feels like we just keep on going on about what we're doing. We never get an opportunity to say the why of what we do and the heart behind why we do it. And there's tons of ways that we form community at KXC. We've got XLP, we've got Serving on Cafe, we've got doing Welcome Team, we've got the Sunday services, you've got Hospitality Sunday, and of course all the other informal ways that people get to know each other and build community, going for dinner at people's houses, having coffees, etc., etc. But the two ways that we want to specifically talk about in the next 2 weeks are two kind of key parts of the life of KXC, and it's Hubs and Pattern. Hubs and Pattern, for those of you who don't know, are just the kind of the smaller communities that we exist in outside of the Sunday services. And as I said, we just want to spend the next 2 weeks just sharing our heart behind why we do what we do. And honestly, when me and Pete James have our meetings, our reviews, where we sit down and talk about Hubs and Pattern, we honestly ask the question on a regular basis, like, should we even do Hubs? Should we even do Pattern? Should we just scrap the whole thing? Because if it's not serving the vision, if it's not serving the purpose that we feel it's called to serve, then let's just scrap it, let's be done with it, because we can't really be asked with that. But we really, generally, these are not the end in themselves. These are vehicles that we see as like serving the purposes, serving the vision of becoming a reckless community. And I'm going to look at Hubs this week, and then Pete James is going to look at Pattern next week. And just for those of you in the room who don't know what Hubs are, I'm just going to do a really quick dummies guide. Not that you're all dummies in any way, shape, or form, but maybe some of you are. So if you were a new person and you go and look on our website, you can see some of the things that we do at KXC, and one of them is Hubs. And Hubs are groups of 10 to 20 people who meet throughout the week, and they meet together for different purposes. And basically what we do in these groups is we want to live in the story and we want to live out the story of Jesus. And there's three different types of Hubs. There's village hubs, which meets around a local area, people in a local geographical area who say we want to meet together, we want to learn what it is to follow Jesus in this area and how we can love our community. There's also activity hubs, which is pretty much what it says on the tin, people gathering around a particular activity, something, maybe we even have a surf hub at KXC. We have book club hub, and people who love doing these things, and it's their hobby, it's what's in their hand, what they love to do, and they want to ask the question of what can God do through this hobby, this interest that I have, and kind of form a community around that. And the final one is course hubs, and course hubs is maybe just when someone wants to take an opportunity to take some time out to get some training in a specific area, etc. So as you go and peruse our plethora of hubs that you'll see on the website in your own time, not in during a Sunday service, obviously. You will see a ton of different types of hubs that we do. You've got the lovely Brixton hub, and I really need to say to the Perrys at some point, we need to change your picture because your foreheads, as beautiful as they are, perhaps your faces are even more beautiful. But I actually, confession time, I haven't got round to telling you about it because it makes me laugh every time I see it, so I've decided to keep it. Anywho, as you go and look at those hubs, you can go and click on a particular one, find one, and it will tell you that who's leading that hub, what the vision of that hub is, and what the patterns of meeting are. And we work in a termly cycle. So the hubs, at the beginning of the term, what we say to all the churches, we say, what is in your hand? Is there anything that God is stirring in you where you want to find something? Maybe it's your local area, maybe it's an activity, maybe it's a course, whatever it might be. Is there something stirring in you that you sense that you want to lead something, lead one of these communities? And you go away and you think about it and you write up a vision and you discuss it with Pete and I and you come up with some of the patterns that you will have in order to exercise some of this stuff. And then you go and share it over a two-week period with the rest of the church, and the rest of the church come and have a look and say, actually, do you know what? I live in that area. I want to think about what it is to love that area. I love that activity too. Why don't I join in that vision along with you? And what you do is you sign up, and you're going to get a lovely automated email which promises you that the hub leaders will get in touch with you at some point and let you know the information. That is effectively what we do with hubs. That's the practical, the boring bit. I wanted to get it out of the way. Done, dusted, boom. So this is that is what we do. The reason we want to have these 2 weeks is to share why we do what we do. And to be a reckless community through our hubs is what we believe we need to do, is we need to be people that live in the story and live out the story of Jesus. And I'd love it by the end of today, if you're in a hub, you're looking at the term ahead, that you get excited about what God could be doing in your community. And if you're not in a hub, that actually you maybe start to think about whether you want to join a hub and get excited about what God could do through that community. And if you are not in a hub and at the end of the day you still don't want to join a hub, then I forgive you entirely. And just maybe there's something that you can take away, some of the general principles about what it means to be a reckless community. So the first thing, living in the story of Jesus. And first thing, whose story is it in the first place? What is the story? And fundamentally, the story isn't our story. At the beginning of creation, I was not around. I didn't do anything to contribute to it, but there was one who was around. His name was Jesus. And everything was made in him, everything was made through him, and everything was made for him. And the whole story of what we are a part of is fundamentally not about us. It is entirely about him. He came on this mission to restore and renew the earth. He came because he saw that God and humanity were broken apart, that there was a tearing apart, there was a lack of relationship. He saw that there was a lack of relationship between humanity, like men and men and women, just struggling in community. It was a breaking apart of that. And there was a struggling of between the relationship between humanity and the world and culture. And Jesus came on a mission to restore all those things. And it is an incredibly reckless story. From beginning to end, it is completely and utterly reckless. Like, you start with the incarnation, God's movement towards us, God's movement towards a world that had rejected him, had left him and gone away and chosen to step away from him. But in his freedom, without being forced, he chose to come towards us. He chose to make a movement towards us. When we gave him zero reason to do so, he did this reckless act of saying, I'm coming towards you. Just like the father in the story that Jesus, that's awkward, Pete shared at the beginning of the story. Well done, Pete. And what it shows, a distinct lack of care of himself, a complete reckless act of being born to a woman who couldn't even afford to find a bed for him. That he was born in the midst of a scandal. He was born without status. It is absolutely, utterly ridiculous that the king of the world would be born to such a woman in such a situation. And entering into a world that was broken, where darkness was reigning, the light of the world came into that darkness. And of course, as soon as light comes into the darkness is going to be threatened by it. And it was complete and utterly reckless, because the darkness wants to destroy anything that is good. And as soon as Jesus entered the world, he was on this almost collision course towards the cross, because darkness was set on destroying this light of the world, this good thing. And the cross makes God look ridiculous. The cross is foolishness, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians. That God would be humiliated, that God would suffer, that he'd be ridiculed, that he'd be punished for sins that he didn't even commit. And we worship that God, that reckless God. And then the resurrection, 3 days later, when he rises again, it's like Jesus bursts out from the grave and he shows that he is victorious over all things, that sin and death cannot have any hold on him, that he has power over all things. And it finally looks like God is making some good decisions. And then he suddenly does the reckless thing of saying, actually, do you know what? I'm not going to stay in my bodily form, continually doing the healings and the miracles and feeding people and giving people dignity and giving people community and forgiving people. Like, he says the utterly ridiculous, I just want to say stupid thing of saying, actually, I'm going to go and I'm going to leave you my spirit. And I'm going to entrust you, humanity who screwed it up in the first place, I'm going to give you my spirit and I'm going to trust you to be my body. I'm going to ask you to be the people that bring the restoration. I'm going to ask you to be the people that forgive. I'm going to ask you to be the people that heal, that give dignity, etc., etc. It is utterly reckless from beginning to end at this story that we follow. But it's this story, this reckless story, that gives us permission and confidence to be reckless ourselves. In Matthew 7, Jesus says, "Everyone who hears these words of mine and does them will be like the wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the wind blew and beat on that house, but it did not fall, because it had been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who builds his house on the sand. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the wind blew and beat against that house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it." That there are plenty of things in our lives that would be almost like easier for us to build our lives around. Things that are tangible, things that we can control, things like our career, things like financial security, things like our popularity, getting married, etc., etc. All these things that we could grab onto and build our hopes and our dreams and our expectations on those things. They can sometimes feel like more tangible things than this story that we have that Jesus says to build our lives on. But when the storms of life come, and notice that Jesus says that the storms will come to the foolish and the wise man. If your foundations are shakable, you're in trouble. If you build your lives on something that's unstable, it's going to be very difficult for you to have permission to be reckless yourself. And I met this amazing guy when I was at university. Incredible man of faith. And actually, at my baptism, so when I was like quite a new Christian, he was the first person to say to me that I see leadership gifting in you, and which was quite remarkable because there was zero potential on display at the time. And he also was the person that taught me how to hear the voice of God, something I'd be I'm always incredibly thankful for. And about 5 years ago, quite early in the morning, I got a text from someone saying, "Anna, can you pray? Because Colin's been taken into hospital. He had some kind of hemorrhage or fit in the night, and he's in a serious and critical condition." And really sadly and tragically, he passed away, and he left behind a wife and children. And I went to his funeral, and it was one of those moments which, you know, will just be seared in my mind forever. It's when his wife got up, and she was like, utterly radiant. There's no words to describe what I saw when she stood up, and she talked about the gut-wrenching pain that she was in, just the desperate like darkness that she was sensing at the time. And it was and then she shared about just did a phenomenal tribute to him, and she finished with these words, and she said, "It was a privilege to be his wife. But my life is not over. As much as I loved him, he was not my reason for living. Jesus is, and he is alive." Now that's someone who builds their life upon a rock. That's someone who, when the storms of life hit, she's built her life upon the rock. Her hopes, her dreams, her expectations are on firm foundations. And if we were to summarize the story, this story that she has chosen to build her life on, we would summarize it by saying that in three words, that God is good. And it's one of the key issues of our discipleship. Do we actually believe that God is good? How do we come to understand that this God who has displayed himself in such a way is truly who he says he is today, forever, and always? And it's a constant wrestle that we have to go on, and a journey that we have to learn to live in this story, to stay in the story when things challenge that truth that God is good. When things come against us, it is a wrestle, and it is tough, and it is hard. And it doesn't happen overnight. Our discipleship won't happen like that. You don't meet somebody in one-time encounter and become their best friend. It takes time to get to know someone. And it's the same with God. It takes time to actually truly believe that he is as good as he says he is. And to be a disciple is effectively means to be a learner. And we're on a discipleship journey, a learning journey of understanding and knowing day after day the goodness of God. And to help us in how we live in this story, I want to introduce you to a friend of mine. His name, I affectionately call the Hof. His name is actually Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and he isn't a friend of mine. And if we met, I don't think we'd actually get on that well, because he's very intense, doesn't have much personality. And also, he's not alive, sadly. That's awkward. Anyway, I tried to choose a flattering photo of him where he looked kind of cool, edgy, East London vibes, that maybe we could connect with him in some way. He was an incredibly fascinating character, and I do encourage you to read any of his books. But he was a German theologian before the Second World War and during the Second World War. And just like a fascinating man, wrote some phenomenal books. And interesting, like just before the war was declared, he was on a boat from Germany to New York because he wanted to escape the war. He saw it coming. And when he was on the boat, he just had this real stirring and was just having this massive wrestle with God and thinking, how can I be a part of the rebuilding of Germany if I don't live in the suffering, if I'm not standing with her during this time? So when he got to America, he got back on the boat. And it was the last boat that left New York before war was declared. And despite being someone who was very obviously against the Nazi party, he ended up being recruited by them as a spy. Funnily enough, he turned out to be a double agent and be working for the British. And he was actually arrested for conspiring towards a plot to kill Hitler. And he was put in prison and spent most of the war in prison. And really sadly, 2 weeks before the prison was liberated, he was executed. But Bonhoeffer was a phenomenal guy because during the time before the war, when the church was actually in many ways colluding with what was happening, because we have to understand that Germany was one of the most Christian nations in Europe at the time, which is terrifying to think that one of the most evil regimes ever to come across, to move on the planet, I can't think of a way to say that, that found root within a Christian nation, that is utterly terrifying. But the church was very much in collusion because it kind of become obsessed with the narrative of German supremacy. Its foundation had ceased to be Christ, and it had become like co-opting the values of the German state. And what Bonhoeffer was arguing, was desperately pleading for the church to do, was to be radical and to stop conforming to the world, but stop conforming to Christ, to stop compromising. But equally, what he wasn't saying was, he wasn't saying be so holy that what you have to do is then remove yourself away and take yourself off into a little hermitage and live separate from the world. What he was saying was push against compromise and push against retreat. And that's where you'll live a life of discipleship. When you're saying, I'm going to be full out, sold out for Jesus Christ, you are going to be my rock. I will not compromise, but I'm going to do that in the world, not away from the world. And when Bonhoeffer wrote his book, The Cost of Discipleship, he finished it and was actually in turmoil because he realized how absurdly hard what he was asking people to do was. And his answer was this: community. And he then wrote a book called Life Together. And he realized that there was no other way for the Christian to exist unless we were in community. Because it's in community that we grow up, because it's in community that we become more Christ-like, and it's in community we mature. And one of the things I sense that God's saying to us as KXC is to a church that is relatively young, and actually, if we look at the average age of this congregation, this church, compared to the national average, we are distinctly much, 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 much younger. And that presents us with some opportunities, but it also presents us with some challenges. And one of the things I feel like God is saying to us is it's time to mature, it's time to grow up, KXC. It's time to actually stop looking for the spiritual parents that are desperately longing for them, but actually for you to rise up and be spiritual parents as well. And we desperately do need to pray. Hear me right on this one. We need to pray for different generations to come into this church because we desperately need the wisdom of the older generation. But he is saying to us, he's like, we need to take a responsibility for ourselves. We need to mature. We need to grow up. And the ways that Bonhoeffer saw the community working, and one of the ways that we grow up and kind of become this reckless community that lives in this story full out, sold out for Jesus, is that we talk to each other, that we serve one another, that we sit in silence with one another, that we worship together, that we read together, that we eat together, that we encourage one another, that we forgive one another, because we will disagree at times and there will be times when we don't get on and we have to work through that. That's part of growing up. That's part of maturing. That we pray for one another. When one of us is going through a really difficult situation, we say, I'm going to hold you in prayer, that I'm actually going to ask and intercede for you, that we're going to tell stories of what God is up to, that we will give generously to each other and we will read the Bible together. And that is what we do in our hubs. That's why will we do what we do in our hubs. We say, like, you know, let's do this stuff to keep us in this story, to grow us, to mature us, that we would start to become more like Christ. And the final thing I want to say on this thing of living in this story is as a reckless community, is that we need each other. We desperately need each other. Genesis 3, God said, it's not good for man to be alone. I will make him a suitable helper. Now, at the time when God says that to Adam, there's been no fall, and he's in perfect relationship with humanity, that there is no distance between them. But even at that point, he looks at man and says, it's not good for man to be alone. And he says, I'll give you a helper. And that word in the Hebrew is Azir, and it's used 21 times in the Old Testament. And most of the times it's used in the Old Testament, it's actually a word used to describe God. As one who rises up in a life-threatening situation, this is a powerful thing. And God is calling us to rise up, to stand alongside one another, and when we're in situations and saying, I will be here to keep you in this story, that we're going to live in this story, we're going to live in this story together, you're going to remain in him. And keep doing that again and again to one another. And for those arrogant people in the room like me, we're actually going to need to learn to be helped by people, to be in community and allow people to help us to stay in community, that we cannot do this alone. It's not a sign of our weakness that we need each other. It's not a sign of brokenness that we need community. It's actually a sign of strength. It's just a sign of us being human, because that's who God created us to be. He looked at us and said, it's not good for you to be alone. You need community. It's part of our strength. So if that's what it is to live in the story of Jesus, to live out the story of Jesus, it's us rooting ourselves in the story, not just for the sake of rooting ourselves in the story, but that so we might live it out. That as recipients of restoration, that actually we become agents of restoration. And in the story, as I said, this reckless story of Jesus, his last act in his resurrection as he left was to say, like, I'm giving you my spirit that you will continue doing what I have been doing. You will continue to advance and extend the kingdom. And therefore, we get caught up in this story and we get to live it out. And therefore, it's going to make us act in reckless ways. And Jesus told these stories in Matthew 13. The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field. When a man found it, he hid it again, and then in his joy went and sold all he had and bought that field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls. When he found one of great value, he went away, sold everything he had and bought it. That's the story of someone living recklessly, that they would go and sell everything that they have. Like, that is ridiculous. That's reckless behavior. But it makes perfect sense. When you realize that what they're selling is not worth anything compared to what they're gaining. And we're going to act in ways that seem reckless, but it's because what we gain is so much more than what we could ever give. And we have to be a reckless community, simply because the one we imitate himself was reckless. Like, he moved towards us in our brokenness when we were still his enemies. He sacrificed himself for us. He gave everything he had for this restoration and redemption, renewal of this whole earth, including us. And Jesus' life was God's way of declaring, of shouting out, of saying to everyone, this is who I am. And who he was one who existed for others, which is why Bonhoeffer says the church is only the church when it exists for others. The church can only be the body of Christ when it exists for others, because that's how Jesus lived. Jesus, in his life, his death, his resurrection, acts with holy purpose towards the interests of others. He didn't come to serve his own agenda. He came to serve humbly, to sacrifice, to love, to heal, to forgive. And that's the way he calls us to posture ourselves. And therefore, that's why we ask our hubs to practice courage, compassion, and creativity, whether village hub, activity hub, course hubs, to practice these things, to learn the ways of Jesus, to live a reckless life, to be a reckless community. And if the church was a boat, there's one boat, if we were going to compare it to any boat, there's one boat it wouldn't be, and that's a cruise liner. Because if we were on a cruise liner, we'd have Pete and Bea and all the hub leaders serving us our food. They would be our waiters, they would be our chefs, they'd be our entertainers, and I'm sure Pete would be a fantastic entertainer. But just that would all, the only purpose that would serve is that we're comfortable, we're well fed, we're well looked after, and we're enjoying ourselves, we're enjoying the ride. But that is not the kind of church that God has called us to be. And quite frankly, I don't want anything to do with that kind of church. What a completely and utterly boring existence for starters. But that is not who God has called us to be. That is not what the body of Christ is meant to be on this earth. And I want to finish by giving you an alternative picture of what we could be, what kind of boat we could be. And this is just taking off something from a prophetic word that someone shared last weekend. And it's staying on the World War II theme. And it's a clip from the film Dunkirk. And I don't know if any of you have seen this film. Has anyone seen this film? It's a very good film. I really like it. Definitely go and see it. But one thing I will warn you about, it is utterly exhausting. Like, it is, like, terrifying. It's just, like, tragedy after tragedy. And you're thinking, gosh, this is exhausting. I'm forgetting to breathe at points because it's just overwhelming. And I had the unfortunate experience of sitting next to someone who felt the need to commentate on every single thing that was happening. It was in Somerset. It would never happen in London. And honestly, she was just sat there. It's just like there was a really poignant moment when you've got the long line of like the beach and you've got these lines of men waiting. And she's just like, gosh, look at them all just standing there, just lining up, just waiting. Oh gosh, the Germans are coming. Oh gosh, the bombs. And then they just stand up again and they wait in line. And I was just like, honestly, please, I was so close to saying something. I was thinking, gosh, does your husband not realize what you're doing? Or is he just so used to it? Anyway, the other grievance I have to share, this is before I get on to how, you know, poignant it was, is that Harry Styles was acting in it, and I just couldn't understand it. It was so confusing. You're, like, totally absorbed in this narrative of World War II, and then Harry Styles from One Direction pops up. It was a bit confusing. Anyway, for those of you who aren't historians or aren't familiar with the history of it, Dunkirk was where 400,000 British and French soldiers had found themselves in the northern beach of France, a town of France. They'd found themselves surrounded by the German army, and they were effectively basically sitting ducks for the Germans to take them out. And it was just a ridiculous situation. It was a desperate disaster. And all the boats that were coming in, the army boats to come and rescue them, had just been thwarted by planes, etc. And it was just looking like a hopeless situation. And I'm just gonna we're just gonna watch a quick clip of the Dunkirk film. Hopefully, it won't ruin it for you. I don't think it will.
We shall go on to the end. We shall never surrender.
The call went out. We have to go to Dunkirk. Ready on the stern line.
What are you doing? You know where we're going.
Into war, George.
I'll be useful, sir.
What has happened is a colossal military disaster.
Watching it again. Stop. It was very good, but, you know, we just once. There's this moment in the film where, you know, we're exhausted by this point. It's kind of near the end, and it's like every attempt that they've had to get away has been thwarted again and again and again. And then there's this moment of hope, when one of the generals looks through his binoculars and he sees something, and it's just the first glimmer of someone on someone's face that you've seen of hope. And someone says, "What have you seen?" And he says, "I've seen home." And what he saw was over 700 fishing boats of all different shapes and sizes coming over as the English had set out this alert of saying, like, our people, 400,000 people are stranded on the beach. Will you go? Will you go and get them? And home didn't wait for them to come back, but home went and found them. And we had talk about homecoming at KXC, people coming home to the Father, and we desperately long to see that. But I also think that God is calling us to be the people that take home to others, that we go and find those people. And if we're going to be compared to a boat, let's be compared to that kind of boat. As people who recklessly take whatever is in their hand, they say, "I've got a boat, I will go." And actually, someone at the first service came up to me and said her granddad had been on Dunkirk, and he was one of those people that was rescued, and he'd broken his arm in part of the kind of battle. And he, as he was going out on one of the boats, one of his best friends fell into the water, and the packs were so heavy that they ended up, that, like, what would happen is they would sink to the bottom because it was so heavy. And usually when someone fell overboard, they would just have to leave them, just let them drown. Anyway, her granddad, with his broken arm, pulled his best friend back into the boat, even though he had a broken arm. And there's this thing of actually in our brokenness, we're still reckless. And we are broken people, aren't we? None of us have got it all together. But even then, we're saying, actually, I want to be this kind of reckless community of saying, you know, I will do whatever it takes. Or whatever's in my hand, I will do it. And the other extraordinary thing about Dunkirk, which didn't get mentioned in the film, it referred to it as a miracle, but what it didn't say is that on the day surrounding it, the king called for an empire-wide 2 days of prayer. And we just got a quick clip again of just some of the footage that was shown on the news, like documenting some of this.
The empire responds to the king's call. And at Westminster Abbey, heart of the empire, the statesmen, the soldiers, the ambassadors, and hundreds of ordinary men and women join the mighty congregation. Her Majesty Queen Wilhelmina of the Netherlands arrives a few moments before their Majesties. No one here today could foresee the grave news that has come from Belgium. All the more, it is well for us to show the world that we still believe in divine guidance, in the laws of Christianity. May we find inspiration and faith from this solemn day.
Picture this, all over the country, people lined up outside churches and chapels to fast and pray to bring these men home. And realistically, the army were expecting to save 40,000 men out of the 400,000. That's what they were anticipating. That was what they were thinking. That's probably what we can achieve. In reality, they ended up bringing home over 330,000. That's a third of a million people they managed to rescue. And unexplained incidences happened, like a storm brewing over the German camp, which meant that they couldn't fly some of their planes. Extraordinary things happening, like the Channel Tunnel became like a mill pond over the 9 days of rescue that took place. And things that historians still kind of confused over as to why Hitler, when he had the opportunity to wipe out the British army, chose to halt his army for 3 days rather than pursue and to completely annihilate them. Instead, 330,000 people were rescued under the nose of the German army. And I believe, I really do believe what we're seeing is God doing something in KXC where he's calling us to take on this baton of prayer and intercession. And what we know, I've been sensing basically since December, since my granny passed away, is my grandparents were people of prayer and they prayed for me every single day of my life. And I think I'm standing here because of that. And what we see in that generation that's passing away is people who prayed faithfully, who prayed again and again and again. And whereas we in our generation, we've got so much to learn from them because what we do is we pray when we feel like it. And what God is calling us to do is be people who pray, of people who fast. Because if we want to see the miraculous breakout, if we want to see the statistics turn around where people are saying that the church that is going to be wiped out within in the UK, that we're overwhelmed, we're outnumbered, and that we're on a seemingly hopeless mission where the odds are stacked against us. If we're going to see any of that change, well, we're going to have to be a people that learn how to pray again. And hand on the tiller, those fishermen, when they were driving their boats over, or sailing their boats over to Dunkirk, when they had those people, they would have been terrified for their lives. When they had, 70 men in their boat, they would have thought, what difference am I making? There's 400,000 men. What difference am I making? I'm just like a speck of a dent in this tiny, this huge wave of people that need to be rescued. Those people who are praying and fasting, they probably would have thought, like, what's the point? It's a hopeless situation. But reckless community looks like people not in glamorous, it's not like reckless community doesn't always look glamorous. It isn't always professional. It looks like ordinary people faithfully living in and out the story of Jesus. Say, I'm committed to being in this story, that I'm not going to leave. Whatever happens, I'm going to choose to root my life and set my life upon this. And I'm going to make sure that the people around me go the same direction. And that they're going to be people, we're going to be people who pray, who say, I'm going to pray for my friends, I'm going to pray for my family, I'm going to pray for my colleagues. I'm going to be the kind of community that goes out and shares the love of Jesus with people. And when I joined KXC a year ago, me and Pete James had a chat about our vision for Hubs and what we sensed God doing. And there was this moment where it definitely felt like a God thing of this vision, this dream, this aspiration of saying, wouldn't it be incredible if every hub, every term saw at least one person become a Christian? Wouldn't that be a thing to pray for? Wouldn't that be a thing to aspire to? And then when I started talking about it, I just burst into tears. I could feel the Spirit of Sarah stirring in me. And I think that's what he's stirring in us. He's stirring us and say, will you be the kind of reckless community that isn't content to live on a cruise ship, but is actually wanting to be like one of those boats from Dunkirk, where say, I take whatever is in my hand, whatever I've got, I'm going to play my part, even though I'm broken, even though I'm hurting myself, I'm going to do this, I'm going to be a part of this. And this is effectively what we want to, it's what we want to do in our hubs. And I'd love to just take some time now just to pray and ask what the Spirit is stirring in us. Maybe he wants to just get us really excited about the term ahead. Maybe he wants to challenge you and say, or maybe, you know, it's time for you to join a hub. Or maybe he's just simply saying, it's time for you to get off the cruise ship.